It's not easy butchering people. It's hard work. You know, there's a lot more like me.
We're talking to serial killers.
Serial killers!
New terminology.
Are criminals born, or are they formed?
How do we get ahead of crazy if we don't know how crazy thinks?
It's easier to ask for forgiveness than for permission.
Welcome to the Hollow Nine Mindhunter Podcast.
All right. Well, here we are again on the road. The Holden and Tench of the Hollow Nine Network's Behavioral Sciences Division. I'm David Clone, director of the investigative team. And joining me tonight on the road is author T.W. Brown. How are you, sir?
Well, it's been one of those weeks.
Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting. You know, it's like I kind of throw that out there as my general beginning of shows. Like, hey, how's it going? And every once in a while, you say that to somebody who's actually had a lot going on. So, how much you want to tell us and how's it going?
You know, I mean, it started with kidney stones and ends with diabetes. So, I'm a type 2 diabetic now, and it's in its first week.
The first week of forever from now on.
Yeah, and it is, you know, that was the one thing that my endo told me when I saw him. He goes, okay, so we get your numbers down, everything's under control, are you still diabetic? And I said, well, I imagine so. I mean, this is a thing that you, once you got it, right? And he goes, good answer, good. But this is one that you can deal with, you know, if you do some tweaks to the diet and you get out there and exercise. And oddly enough, the day that I saw my doc and she saw the glucose that was 333, which is apparently really high, I'd actually just restarted my workout program and I'd gotten on my Peloton bike and done my ride that morning. So I was already in the, you know, mode that it was time to shake off the fractured hip from Spartan and get myself back in gear. And I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, I injured myself back in September, so my workout regimen just vanished. And, you know, my system hasn't, I mean, because I've regulated my system for so long. I've had the exercise going because you can't go out and hit those Spartan races flat.
Right, you know, right,
you've got to prep for it. You've got to work out, you know. So I've got a, you know, I've got a 60-pound industrial tire in my backyard that I flip. I've got the battle ropes. I've got a weight set. I've got,
wow, you
know, treadmills and a Peloton bike. I've got a full, you know, full weight set in my gym that's out in the garage, and it hasn't been touched since I hurt myself.
All and, agency approved, by the way.
Yes, every bit of it. So, you know, but I'm back on course, and, you know, it's something I can handle. I can manage this.
Well, it's definitely crazy, and sorry to hear it, but lots of luck dealing with that. It's definitely got me thinking about getting myself back in gear with my workout program and eating better, he says as he almost belches into the mic. Oh my God, hold on a second. I thought I just heard like crazy thunder outside. Like, wow, it went from like 0 to 60 in no time out here. But yeah, you know, it's just wild how, especially too, all of a sudden out of nowhere, it's like, hey, you know, it used to be a lot easier to just jump back on the treadmill and get back into this. And all of a sudden it's like, hey, this is taking longer than it did last time. And like, why am I tired? You know, and age sucks. I'm really not a big fan of it.
Every decade is a new magic number. I mean, the 40s, things changed. When I hit 50, it was just like, good Lord. But the thing is, I don't feel 50. You know, I remember when I was a kid, when I looked at people that were 50 and they looked old to me.
Yeah, man, I know exactly what I think. There's even one of those crazy, weird, rarely used German words for that particular phenomenon of remembering people looking older at the age that you are when you were younger. You know, like, I'm not quite 40 yet, but I'm very close. And I feel exactly the same way, not only about people my age, but even a little bit younger, like people in their 20s. I remember being like, you know, 10 and thinking like people like Holden would look like so old, like, oh my God, by the time I get to that age, I'll have everything figured out and I'll have a nice fat bank account and I'll own a house and have a family and a car that's paid off. And, you know, it's like, it's weird. It's almost like I've been realizing lately that a lot of these sort of preconceived ideas of what adulthood was going to be like for me was based on these ideals I had from watching movies and TV shows. But I didn't take into account that even at those times, the most modern one was just showing me what being adult was like at that time. So yeah. By the time I got to be that age, like, everything about life would be different. Everything, you know, who would be thinking about, like, you have to figure out which internet bundle with your cable and your cell phone you want to make sure that you can do all these things. Like, if you're podcasting, you don't just want the shitty internet. You don't want just like 100 megs up and down. You need like 3 or 4. And what if the thing in your area only offers 2? You know, like, you're just like, holy shit, that even wasn't a thing when I was a kid. Just like, I don't remember an FBI agent ever coming to my school to talk to me about disturbing behavior.
Yeah, after being heavily edited by a principal who tickles children for
this episode. Holy shit, what a sort of I want to say milestone of the season, because once this happens, it's definitely we're in the final stretch of episodes of the season here. Episode 8, we have 9 and 10 left after this, right? And it's just like, it almost feels like longer than 10 episodes for sure this season. Actually, hold on, I'm gonna quickly
double. No, it is 10. Yeah, it is 10. I was just looking at it because I couldn't believe that we're this close to done. And, you know, first of all, this is the only episode that doesn't start with a BTK flash.
I think there's like 2 in the first one and this one, like, so the pilot episode and hit this.
Yeah, and it was interesting because as we sort of chatted pre-show, I don't have time to sit down and read anymore, so everything I do is through Audible, and I had an audiobook of this, of Mindhunter, and I was listening to the breakdown of this exact case and how it went down for him and, you know, what he was thinking when it was going on and everything else like that, which some of it comes across here because he's foreshadowing what he's going to, you know, what he would think if that was his kid,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was one of the things that was sort of a driving force for him with this. And it's also interesting the two agents and their different opinions on this.
Yeah.
And this is, to me, a real sign of the times. You're seeing new generation, old generation viewpoints here, because the older guy's like, look, it's not a big deal. The younger guy is, yeah, this is a really big deal. And of course, now that would be the lead-in story of the local news.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
okay. You have to think, look at that principal. He's older generation. And I understand what he's trying to do. And I'm certainly not defending what this principal was doing by tickling the kids and then giving them basically what I call hush money. But, you know,
grooming, by the way, there's a term for it now.
Yeah. Tickles and stuff, you know, but it's like, the thing is neither of them saw anything wrong with what he was doing. The principal, you know, and it shows how we evolved into personal boundaries, but it also showed how we devolved into a massive distrust of everything.
Well, there are a lot of layers at play, though, in this particular sequence, because the thing to me that should have been the thing that ended it, even before it got to the point of, you know, maybe this principal eventually losing his job, is the fact that this was a complaint coming from other teachers and parents. Like, as soon as parents got involved, and all I can think is the school system I grew up going through, as soon as parents got involved, and especially if they were parents who had a lot of fucking money or had businesses that were influential, that was when everybody at the school lost their goddamn minds. So to me, the minute a parent said something, if a principal brushed them off like, I don't have a covenant with you, my covenant is with your children.
Yes.
That's some sick shit right there. That's some, like, let's shuffle this priest around to another parish to, you know what I mean? That's
poor Catholics.
Well, now the thing is, though, and I did want to, before we get too far away from it, posit this idea. By having this replace the BTK open, which, spoiler alert, hopefully you guys are at this point on board with the fact that we talk about that openly. Is that supposed to imply that, because what we do see is a close up of him editing the speech that Holden is going to give to the class.
Right.
Is this implying that he is of the same type of mindset that the BTK killer is and that the kind of people that Holden is dealing with already are? Or is it trying to say flat out that he is a serial killer in the making? You know what I mean? Like, to me, like that this pedophile left unchecked will eventually become a BTK who not only tickles the kids, but has them tied up in the trunk of his car and back at his house in the basement and whatever the hell else, you know, because to me, like, if you've already set up that that's what we're seeing at the beginning of these episodes is this future to be found horrific serial killer. And you're replacing it with this guy and what he's doing. Like, is he zeroing in on these words because of his own personal identification with them? You know, is that what we're supposed to get from that?
Well, it's interesting when you go through the Mindhunter book written by the guy that this is all based on. What he sees is the potential and in how controlling this guy is. I mean, he's going to have the say. And one of the benchmarks that you find in a lot of these serial killers that he was finding and that they found to be a normal trait is that need for control, that mm-hmm. need for control. And here he is, he's looking at the FBI guy and saying, I'm not going to let you say these things. I'm the person in control here. Even though you're an FBI agent and I'm just the principal, I'm in charge of you right now. I'm going to tell you what you can and can't do. And so there is a control issue there, but you also see how the Brutos case is sort of affecting his mindset. You're seeing, and they do a really good job in all of their episodes when they've got kind of side cases that are feeding things and saying how it really shapes their mind on everything they're doing. And he keeps making the point over and over again is we're trying to apply this real world. I'm trying to prevent something from happening.
Right.
And that really was his drive going into this. That really was what he set out to do. And it's interesting to get some of his backstory prior to joining the FBI and to find out, you know, that he was a bit of a screw up in school and he failed out of college and got kicked out for a while and went back under probation, basically, that said, if you don't keep, you know, solid A's, your ass is out again. And, you know, I mean, yes, he served in the military. He was in the Air Force, but he was in charge of the recreation department on the base. I mean, that was his job. He wasn't a war vet, so to speak, you know. So
he also, so this is Holden we're talking about, right? Yeah. So he kind of has that sort of, until you know that, until he tells us that, it's kind of like he's got that straight-laced, straight-A student, overachiever, remind the teacher that you can give us homework on Friday thing going on.
It's an overcompensation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess because he also had no choice, too. It was sort of like you can't be second best at all. You have to be top of your class if you want to stick around.
And you have to also remember, he joined the FBI during the last of the Hoover era. And Hoover had total control of the FBI. So, you know, this was a very buttoned down operation that even the president was afraid of Hoover. I mean, right. When we find out later what kind of guy he was, but Hoover ran that show completely and almost autonomously without any input. And he had very hard, fast, strict regs, and you didn't dare break outside of them.
And it seems like Daniels, their supervisor, is very much a holdover of that. But ironically, I didn't even notice the connection of the fact that the principal is tickling the kids' feet and the connection to Bruto's obsession with shoes, as well as I'm watching the episode in the background right now, and I'm at a scene where Debbie is in the tub and Holden is giving her a foot rub, and they're talking about the principal, and she's kind of like agreeing with him that there's something a little off about that. And the fact that he's rubbing her feet and they're showing that it's an intimate thing and it's actually inappropriate for a principal to be kind of doing this on such regularity. And the fact that there's a compensation thing, like a hush money thing involved, but it's not even hush money because he didn't think there was anything wrong and didn't tell them to not spend the money and not to.
Everybody says it's common knowledge. Everybody, I mean, the teachers, remember when he interviews all the teachers, they all say it's common knowledge. And you have two teachers, and oddly enough, it's the two older teachers who are against it and the younger teacher who's supporting the principal. So it's really interesting how the older teachers are against and the older FBI doesn't care. The younger teacher is for and the younger FBI is against. I mean, it's all these kind of crossing over. I mean,
probably have their own reasons for it, though. You know, like Tench, I think, doesn't want to imagine the fact that this could be something his kid could be vulnerable to. And you notice that's a big part of what his reaction is being driven by because of how much angrier he gets when Holden says, imagine this was happening to Brian. And then he gets like, that's when he gets up and just puts on his jacket to leave. He's like, all right, I'm not having this conversation anymore, because he already can't be like a real regular dad to Brian. He's having a big challenge with that because of what we know watching this with 2018 eyes is as autism. They have no concept of how to even approach at that point in the 70s. And so he's already got that going against him. The fact that he now is going to have to imagine this type of a level of vulnerability every time he sends him off to school, that this kind of shit could be happening or worse, you know, like, to be honest, the foot tickling is pretty benign when you consider all the other heinous things that they're running into people who do in throughout the rest of the season. So, and throughout the season up until now, but it's the fact that the principal is so staunchly stubborn about not even being open to considering that it's inappropriate. You know, that the fact that not only the older teachers, and I think it's interesting that you said the older teachers, because they would be the ones who might be more, how do I want to say this? They might be more familiar with the idea that this kind of behavior has a history of being covered up or hidden or intimidated away from the light of day. And so for them to kind of see this brewing in something that the principal is doing and know that he's in a position where he'd be able to cover it up, you know, like they kind of feel an obligation. This is one spot in their lives. And this is also a time where I think women's liberation is still kind of a new thing. I mean, it's like, as we've seen now, change is slow, right? Society doesn't know what the hell it's doing most of the time. They could see the forest for the trees. Like, this is going to start here, but this guy will eventually have a dead kid in his trunk. And I think it's interesting. Maybe the young woman is afraid for her job, you know, and
I thought she had a bit of a crush on the principal.
That I was gonna say too, but I didn't know it. I mean, if it was
he's a senior employer, he's senior on the ladder, he's the authority figure there, and you know, so you got that whole daddy issue thing or whatever you want to call it, but she sees him in a different light than the older women see him. They see him as a peer and a contemporary, and she sees him as an authority figure.
Well, plus, too, there's the idea she could also see him as a father figure as well. Yeah. Who knows what kind of psychology is also attached to that.
Yeah, so there could be the workplace crush going on. It's not uncommon.
And then maybe for Holden, because he doesn't have children, but he's so ready to deploy these new sort of things that he knows to look out for after speaking to all these serial killers. Like, he goes back to Brutus in this episode by himself.
Yes.
And Brutus first expresses that he misses Bill, which is always, you know, nice.
Fun.
But I think it's interesting how he gets Brutus to tell him the details about what he did by talking about a hypothetical other person who could have done it, because that follows Brutus's logic of his story is that it wasn't him and he's being framed, you know, but he could also provide commentary on what probably the mentality was of the person who would have done it. You know, and it's
that is the interesting thing. And again, this is more of the insight from reading the book and hearing how he worked and what some of the ideas that they came up with. And part of the idea that they came up with was to give these guys an out. to give them a way, in fact, to get them to almost confess to their crimes by almost saying, look, we know it wasn't your fault. You know, you probably panicked and this was the last minute thing. But to basically get them to sort of shift their perspective, because one of the things that he says about Brutus in the book is how much of a pathological liar this guy was. I mean, he was, you know, the guards warned them as they walked in, don't believe a word that comes out of this guy's mouth. He is completely delusional and a total liar. Everything that he says is going to be a lie. I mean, they show him that picture where you can see his face reflected. And I'm not sure if that's in a later episode, if I'm spoiling it.
It was in a previous episode.
Yeah. And he's still denying to this, you know, to up through all these interviews that he had done anything. And so that was part of their, of the things that they were working out. And that was to kind of shift things a little bit. And instead of coming at him and saying, why did you do this? Why did you do that? You know, and give him a, what do you think the person doing this might've thought? And then eventually even going so far as to, you know, finally sort of drop it in there going, well, you didn't mean to do it though, did you? You know, yeah. Really, really just trip them up on their own words. And you see that at play. And after listening to that book, I keep wanting to say reading. So if I slip up and say reading, but after going through the Mindhunter book, it was so interesting to watch these episodes and see that psychology at work.
Mm. I mean, obviously they studied this as part of prepping for the show for sure. But for what I understand, and I got to get James Nopon-Mosia on this podcast because he is a huge David Fincher fan and has a lot of insights on some of the behind the scenes of not only this, but other Fincher projects. But from what he understands, the actor who played Brutus was really one of the things that kind of struck him right away when they were working with David Fincher. You know, he's notorious for doing several takes, like almost overkill number of takes,
right?
Very meticulous to get things right. And you know, you hear about that, but until it actually happens, you're not really sure what to expect. And he said it would be like they would do a take of the scene, and or they would, you know, they would meet and they would talk about the scene, they would do a rehearsal, and David Fincher would watch it and give him like three almost like legal pad notebook size sheets of notes on what to do, and like little, and it's everything down to like the nuance of like, you know, when you hear this line, you're taking that as a joke. When you hear this line, you're actually lying about this. And then they would do the scene again, and he would be watching it from another room on a monitor. And mm-hmm. at the end of the scene, he would come back with another new three pages of notes. Oh, so, wow. I mean, what we're seeing in the final product, especially like, you know, some people would hear that and think like, holy shit, that's crazy. What a fucking asshole. Who would do something like that to his actors? And the thing is, though, if you've never edited something, if you've never tried to put together a sequence shot with multiple camera angles of the same two people, you know, having that many possibilities to choose from is like giving yourself as a painter more colors in your palette and more brushes to use and a wider canvas. And so in my mind, that is one of those sort of like genius level details of like, look, I'm sure this is going to piss people off that we're doing it this way. I'm sure people are going to be not happy about how hard this might be. But think about one of the reasons that this show is so like visually captivating and memorable. Like the first time you watch it through, you're like, holy shit, like I have to talk about this. I have to do a podcast. Otherwise, I can't have this just contained within me. and there are some people who can't get into it. You know, there's some people who maybe it's a little too slow for or a little too, you know, like, you know, creepy. Yeah, that's another thing.
Yeah. Well, and that's a lot of attention span. And I don't want to beat this horse to death, but you touched on the attention to detail that he puts into these scenes. And I want to go to the scene with the new agent, Greg Smith, when he's sitting
in the
control room with the headsets on, listening to that cassette. And who is he listening to? Bittner and Norris. Now, did that mean anything to you at all when he said Bittner and Norris?
to me, what that is, I'm like, oh, if this ever gets released on Blu-ray, there's probably a deleted scene where they went and did an interview with a Bittner and a Norris. And,
and Norris are in the book, and these are two guys who torture to death this girl and record it.
Oh, shit. Wow.
And they had those. They got those tapes. So all I can think is that if he made that poor actor listen to those tapes, that was not acting on that look of horror that he had. And then when he throws the headphones down and then he's asked,
you hear like some kind of weird
the screaming and the freaks. Yes. And he goes, still want to be part of this? You know, and it's you could almost have that question being asked not only of the agent, but also him asking this actor, you really want to be part of this production?
Too late now, man. Well, we already cast you. You're in. So you don't want to get fired. That's not going to be good for you.
It's there is so much detail in this. And that's, again, what makes it to me, makes it work so well. And it's something that I have told so many people about. And then I tell them about this show. Yeah. As well, and say, hey, you can hear us talk about it, you know, and hear us break it down. You like watching The Talking Dead? Well, we're better because we're not we don't hold anything back, and we're not getting paid by anybody, so
and we're not, you know, sexual abusers trying to hide it behind neurotic personalities. It's like that's the, you know, the way of the world. Anybody who's already on TV probably got there through some questionable means, so we're at least on that side of the fence still.
Coming out every week.
One of the things that's also crazy about this is the fact that you brought up that this is the first episode where we have that new team member, and yes, it's the 8th episode. There's only this episode, the two after it. So if we only have this guy as part of the team for 3 episodes, and by the time those 3 episodes are over, it feels like he's been around for the entire season. You know what I mean? It's just one of those things where it's something about the pacing of this show that makes it feel like they've got so much going on. And even sometimes the hour might even feel a little bit longer. And usually that's not something you brag about a show about. Like, yo, man, it feels longer than you actually take.
How could they have contained so much in such a short span of time?
It is impressive. And the fact that you know, at this point we're not even thinking about the brother and sister-in-law and brother-in-law who, you know, that case that they had, and was at Altoona, Pennsylvania. Like, there's all these, we have these crazy landmark cases that have already come and gone, but I almost feel like those were each would have been like full season investigations of other shows, you know what I mean? And at the same time, it works as it all being one season for this show.
Yeah, and the reality was that in real life, they popped those cases and broke them so quickly, you know? And so that's why even though they sort of bleed through the whole season, it also shows you that it was like they were in and out just like that, because their minds were they were programmed so differently from what standard law enforcement technique was. And I'm going to drop sort of the spoiler bomb here for anybody that hasn't heard it yet. But next season, which should be coming out in a few months, is going to focus on the Atlanta child murders. And you get to see them put their stuff to practice, because by the time we hit 1979, they have become more established. And they actually get...
Shut up. Sorry.
They actually get, you know, some credence behind them. This is the whole period during this, they've got no legs to stand on. You know, that they're seen as voodoo and witchcraft. And it's amazing, you know, that they got as far as they did, as fast as they did, because they really became an acceptable branch. But part of that is because Hoover dies.
Yeah. I mean, wow.
Reality is, in the real world, Hoover's death opened the FBI up to new technique. And so I don't know if they'll touch on that as much in season 2, or if they'll really just talk about that case and how much they learned and the methods that they used, the things that failed, the things that didn't work the way they wanted to, because local law enforcement was in a pissing contest with the FBI. I mean, it's interesting, but watching this happen and watching them go from having almost no credibility, because there's another ass chewing in this episode. You went on a gut instinct. And again, it's about this principle.
Yeah. You
know, whole episode seems to be about the principle, but I think what it's really introducing is their ability to evaluate the case on such a different level. And they're doing that with everything. And I think that's what this shows.
Well, when they go to talk to the local law enforcement, he was very much of the same opinion, not as the young woman teacher for the same reason, but he was more like, dude, what the hell? It's foot tickling. Who fucking cares? You know what I mean? Like, it's not a big deal, you know? And it's kind of like, not all local law enforcement is like that. We've already seen local law enforcement that was very welcoming of Holden and Tench showing up and helping them out, you know? And so it's sort of more of that there are certain places where local law enforcement is less advanced and less educated and less open to education, very much sort of paving the way for where we are now in the world and as a country. But with this addition of the new person, it's kind of like, I guess until now we've had this triangle of Holden, Tench, and Wendy Carr. And it's interesting too, because Tench is supposed to represent the sort of old school that always had a slight open mind, because for as much as his old school appears in the fact that he doesn't want to talk about this principal case and that he thinks, you know, he agrees, I think it's more maybe he didn't want to get involved with it because he knew that it would cause this issue with Daniels, that he wouldn't back them up on it, because again, it's like you're sticking your fucking nose into something that you have no. He's like, you know, we don't just show up and investigate shit just because we feel like it. You know, nobody reported anything. But for me, I will always, as much as we, you know, are kind of making our way through the episode, it still keeps coming back to parents, yo. like a full on parent told you to fucking stop touching their kid. And you told them, you don't get to tell me that. You know what I mean? Like, what the, like, right there, that should have been like, you're going to jail, man. I'm sorry. That's the attitude of a pedophile. You know what I mean? That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that when they go back and warn the principal or advise him to stop doing what he's doing, and he blows up, I mean, and gets hyper defensive. You know, and the way he goes at him and basically even tells him at the end when he leaves, you know, you're going to have children of your own someday. And I think you need to think about what kind of world you want to bring them in or whatever. And, you know,
the one where a principal doesn't touch his fucking feet if I tell him not to.
Yeah. You know, and yeah. He wants to you want him to fire back at that moment, you know, something about the parents, you know, and he never actually uses the parents as an effective weapon, I don't think.
But the parents are an interesting case. I mean, like, so there's like this one day investigation where they hit the principal and then a couple teachers and then a couple parents and then go back to the principal. And I'm sorry, what's the new guy's name? Gordon Smith? Is that
Greg
Smith?
Greg Smith.
Greg Smith. You know, one of the things that's interesting is his dynamic and his, you know, rookie greenhornness. And it's funny seeing Holden not being the rookie anymore and trying to take on the Tench like road mentor shoes. But his robotic nature, you know, that's the thing. Holden over the course of the whole season starts to display more and more this kind of like level of potential detachment from humanity that he easily could be one of these killers if he was even slightly less balanced than he is. You know, it's interesting that he's talking about what the signs of disturbing behavior is, yet he is very easily able to get into the mindset of these killers now, you know, and it's kind of, I don't know, he's a quite enigmatic how his charisma works with this show.
It's hilarious. He, in the actor in an interview that I read up on either this week or last week, he said the question he got the most after the season was over was, are you going to become one of the serial killers? And he's like, no, I'm a good guy. And he was stunned that people were watching this show and thinking that because of his characteristics and the way he portrayed himself, that they thought he might become one of the cases eventually, and he thought it was hilarious. He's like, no, I'm based on a real person. I mean, that's not his name, but that's who I'm based on. And how are you
awesome. Up with this? Well, I mean, that also, maybe he's, maybe the surprising thing is that, you know, even in himself, he didn't know that he was coming off that close to the same kind of a person that the serial killers were coming off as in the show, you know, like, and I think for me, it's more that he's so fascinated with them that he cozies up to them so much and that he didn't even, you know, want to acknowledge the danger of that until we see what happens in the finale.
Right. Well, you know? And I'm pretty sure that most of Holden is based on John Douglas. And John Douglas was the agent that wrote Mindhunter and is the original guy. So I'm thinking that that's who they're basing Holden on. And if that's the case, he actually even admits that some of his characteristics are the exact same characteristics that they look for in some of their cases. And he says it's really just a matter of what environmental stimulus was I exposed to that had me going to the FBI and had someone like Dennis Rader become BTK,
right.
Somebody like Brutus or any of these other people that he encounters. And he says that it could have just as easily, he could have just as easily gone the other route. And so I think this really speaks to how well the actor is playing this, because everybody almost to a T that I've spoken to that watched the show has said the same thing. And we've brought it up here a number of times that he could almost be one of the upcoming season serial killers. You know, we're waiting to see what he's going to have come out of his closet. And if he's based on John Douglas, he had a distinguished career and, you know, is still an advisor.
Well, there's also a little bit of an analog to that to things like the movie Manhunter, later remade as Red Dragon. The first one was starring William Peterson and Bill Cox as agents Bill Graham and Hannibal Lecter. And then they redid it with Ed Norton taking the William Peterson role and Anthony Hopkins reprising the Hannibal Lecter role. But they both feature part of that story being that Graham got so into the mindset of the serial killers that he had to go under years of very intense therapy, psychotherapy, to get himself out of that. And that's partly why when he's brought back in on the case that he's brought into for that movie, it's a big deal. It's like having an alcoholic have to go undercover as a bartender. You know what I mean? It's kind of in that vein of, and it led to him almost being killed. Like, he survived being attacked by Hannibal Lecter. And part of that is just because Lecter had sort of a fondness for him from a friend's level, sort of what then gets later becomes more of a romantic thing when Clarice becomes part of the story. He's only got that one story, Bill Graham. He's only in Red Dragon / Manhunter. And so I think the fact that it's called Mindhunter is also supposed to make you think of that a little bit. And so maybe that's partly what we're responding to, is sort of like this like subconscious suggestion that he has a little bit of the Will Graham thing going on. And instead of only seeing the aftermath like we do with Will Graham, we're actually seeing how it happened. And part of it was because of his ambition with this project, you know, that he's, you know, I guess it's more next episode. We see him defending it with a lot more of my and I statements, like, I started this and this was my idea.
Yeah. Well, and the counter is, and so what, you can now read people's minds? I mean, basically.
Yeah, like, you're creating pre-crime from Minority Report here, you know?
You know, I mean, so, I mean, both sides in that moment in the director's office kind of have a legitimate argument. But again, and I think that this episode really does a great job of showing what they were up against in the system, but also showing how they developed what they do. And the fact that while they weren't going to be able to just like talk to somebody and tell if they were going to become some sort of serial killer, they got called in a number of times, all, and they have to be called in. That's just it. Is that a local law enforcement agency doesn't have to call the police, but once it becomes a serial crime, they usually turn to these people. And the reason they do is because they've made their entire careers, and you see it here, figuring out how people think, This is what they became. This is what they specialized in. And they worked so hard. Douglas actually worked so hard that he gave himself almost like a brain aneurysm. He actually lay in a coma in a hotel room for 4 days and was near death.
And didn't nobody know about it? He was just
nobody knew about it. And then when they found him and they brought him into the hospital, they actually had his gravesite picked out in Arlington because he wasn't expected to come out of the coma. And so his wife was bedside vigil. A lot of the other officers in his group were there. And then when he came through, of course, he had to overcome because he had the slur and he couldn't remember things and had to really. And he this happened to him in his late 30s.
Wow.
Because he was working so hard in this division, you know, and I think a really good job is done here showing how it's almost nonstop for him.
Well, is that what happens? Well, I guess we shouldn't talk about it until we talk about the finale. But is that what happens in those last couple moments of the finale? Do you think that they're showing, they're dramatizing that moment of that sort of aneurysm going off and his breakdown is a little bit more of a physical ailment as well as his psychological ailment?
Either that or they're foreshadowing what's to come for him.
Yeah. Well, you never know. It could be like a symptom that somebody complained about that was enough proof of a brain aneurysm that they fell down the stairs in Germany. a little allusion to another show we've got.
Not to one of our other programs, yes. So I think the one thing we have not talked about in this episode is the college party that...
Well, before we get to that, there's one more thing before we leave the principal and everything, and that is to round out the way Gregory Smith's rookie day went. They go on all these interviews, and we get to see these parents that where the dad almost feels like, to me, it feels like he felt badly having the reaction that he did, like almost as if the principal trying to tell him that it was no big deal. He now had almost self-doubt in it. Like he was definitely a little on the subservient side to the wife for sure. The dynamic between them was weird. Yeah. But they definitely landed on if you tell somebody not to touch your kid, they shouldn't touch your kid. And so after that, they are not sure if they're going to go warn the principal or not. And Greg Smith is like, we're the fucking FBI. Why don't we just go tell him? So Holden let the rookie make that call. And when it doesn't go as smoothly as they thought and in the car on the way out that time, then all of a sudden Greg Smith is like, shit, did we do the right thing? And it's like, yeah, shut the fuck up, rookie. Like if I were Holden, I'd be like, you're done talking, dude. You're done talking. Do not speak again.
No more lines for the rest of the day.
until we get back to the office, you keep your fucking mouth shut. You just made me second guess my better judgment. And now I probably am about to get in trouble. And even though I'm smarter than everybody, that's what it is about Holden. He has that I'm smarter than you attitude, and that's what all the serial killers have.
And I hate to, once again, reference the book, but Douglas really does come across that way.
Oh, really? Like, even reading it, you're like, oh, I could tell this guy would be a dick to talk to.
Oh, yeah. I'm like oh.
No wonder Debbie fucks around.
Full of yourself much. Yeah, so, yeah, it does come across that way a few times, and it's hard to realize that. I mean, this guy is part of a group of people that changed the dynamics of law enforcement. I mean, this is a cornerstone now in, I mean, granted, we don't have serial killers everywhere, but
I don't know, man, 35 at that time that we didn't even know about. I mean,
but they're out there. And the thing is these are people that are habitual, and it's not just with that. I mean, it's murder cases in general. I mean, Altoona wasn't a serial case. You know, I mean, and a lot of cases they went on weren't exactly serial cases. You know, there are some cases that as I listen to the book, I'm like, wow, I wonder if they're going to bring this to the season. I wonder. And there's a lot of listening to it going, oh, boy, I hope they touch on that. I hope they touch on this, you know, that kind of thing. But there were a lot of single murder cases that they come in on. And it's how they use these techniques that they're developing now to either A, figure out who did it, or B, get the person to say they did it.
And it's almost like because we know what these guys who got away with this, you know, 20 times were thinking, we're getting you on the first one. And if we think that this is going in the same direction, we stopped you from getting the other 19. You know, so there's still that first victim still has to go for us to know that you're a killer. But after that, as long as we've got some kind of profile that we could compare you to, we can stop you before the spree reaches the double digits.
And think about it. Altoona did not get the desired results they wanted. You know, I mean, they did not come away from that with the convictions that they wanted and the people, you know.
I mean, and it depends on where you fall on that politically, because, again, that district attorney is like, well, we got somebody. Justice was served. The people are happy. You know, that should be enough for you. It's enough for me. Now let's go get steak sandwiches. And these guys are like, fuck you, we're scientists, which maybe this is also for Tench the first time he was able to seriously feel like that. You know, like he is a little bit of an anomaly, and he's one of my favorite characters because he was in Fight Club for sure. And it's like he's an anomaly because it's like he's a bridge between Holden and Daniels. And he is amenable at working with Wendy. And at this point, too, we also see in this episode that they have more of a support staff behind them, too. Like, there's a lot more activity in their office, in their basement office. Like, they have people making copies and...
Yeah, they actually have secretaries now.
Doing shit for them, so they're not doing literally everything themselves. Yeah. But he still has... he still has a lot of uphill battles against Daniels. You know, it's like there's still this sort of resentment that'll seemingly never go away between these guys because of the old school versus new school thing. And I guess when the principal complains about the fact, or no, it's the fact that that Gregory Smith admitted that they did this thing, you know, that the that they went back and spoke to the principal. That is what unleashed the sort of ass chewing that Holden had to deal with. And even that, it's just like, dude, are you really fucking getting on my case for a guy who's touching kids against the parents and teachers' will? You know, like, this makes no fucking sense. This is a really topsy-turvy world if that's what's happening right now.
And I, like you, had the episode sort of screening in the background during part of this. And during that scene, the interesting moment that you have with the final sort of words that were being spoken by the director, and they've got Hoover's picture right in the middle of the frame.
Oh, yeah.
On the wall. You know,
yeah, I mean, cinematography in this is incredible. I mean, you know, you'd expect nothing less from the people who brought us Fight Club and Panic Room and Seven. You know, I mean, all of these movies work on these multi-visual levels, you know, and you even see in this scene a couple of moments when the director looks up at that picture of Hoover, you know, so you could see the sort of like the legacy. It's like, I'm still here. I'm still got your back, sir. You know, I'm still keeping it respectable.
Yep. Because that was one of the biggest laws, and he harps on this. Douglas harps on it a lot in the Mindhunter book, is do nothing that reflects poorly on the FBI.
Ever. Oh, wow.
That's like rule. That was like rule one, you know, just like in your Fight Club, don't talk about Fight Club rule. Rule one in the FBI, never do anything that reflects poorly on the FBI. That was Hoover's number one rule. And if you did, you suffered the wrath of basically God.
Wow. So, yeah. Wow.
That was their biggest rule back then.
But it also shows how, you know, that's that blue wall, you know, that's the whole, you know, brotherhood, nothing, truth is, you know, this is the brotherhood is stronger than truth, which to me, if we're prepared to accept that at that level, how could there not be an Illuminati? And that could be like why things are the way they are, and they could totally be getting away with it because people are okay accepting it at different levels. It's like, well, you know, if you incrementally get them used to accepting it here and then there, and it's like, all right, well, fine, there's one running everything, you know, because that whole idea, like, don't do anything that reflects badly on the FBI, like, even if that means arrest somebody who's like a senator or find, you know, follow an investigation to its actual true conclusion, which could lead to a dirty FBI agent. You know, like, is that what we're talking about, where those things are not going to be taken to the full extent that they need to go to? That's to me one of the things that a lot of not only pop culture, but sort of tell all stories and documentaries are starting to show me has been the case, is that there's a level of corruption that humanity is just prone to and has been present and involved and running more than we are probably ever going to be comfortable accepting. You know what I mean? Or definitely more than people think. And it's interesting that that's how our world works.
And yet we still manage to slowly but surely eke out little moments, you know, that are free of that. And I really believe that this, you know, this time that we're in, you know, I think embracing those is sort of what's more important than jumping on the bad, because we get to sit around and talk about Mindhunter on Netflix.
You know?
I mean, to me, it's pretty good, you know? I mean, it's a pretty good thing. So
it could be a lot worse. You're right, man.
So we're not going to let the bad guys win.
Yeah. And it's interesting, since now that I think that opens the door to the last thing, or the one thing we haven't talked about, as you alluded to earlier, the party, the sort of psychological experiment party that Debbie throws. And as Holden walks into it, what's the first thing he sees is a bank of people listening in on recording devices to all the microphones that are hanging in the room. But how is that not like the way Hoover and eventually Nixon and all the people who are just recording things always and having everything bugged? It's so such an interesting dichotomy of how she's so against his like square, regimented lifestyle, and yet here's this experiment she's got going on that totally avails itself of like FBI surveillance techniques. You know,
here's the interesting thing, is we go back, and this is where I get to do the history spot, you know, that I like to cover in this, is you have to realize Watergate had just been all over television about 2-3 years prior. If we're still around the 74 75 76 era, Watergate was in 72 74, right in there. Let's see, what year did Gerald Ford take over for him? So, I mean, I think 74, and then Carter won the office in 76. So, you know, we're talking about, this all happens within, you know, a stone's throw historically of Watergate, where the whole listening in thing hadn't been all over the news. So now this is some sort of, you know, neat new rad thing to try out and just put it to a different use.
Yeah. I've seen stories about newer versions of this type of experiment as well, but not in as big a room and not with as many people. And I feel like maybe it was even part of like maybe one of those like HBO Real Sex kind of things, where they were like, let's just see what happens when we put a bunch of people in a dark room where they literally can't see who anyone else is in there. And I think there are times where eventually people just wind up like having sex in them. But here we get to see that Debbie was either starting to get bored with Holden or was just getting too close to her lab partner, you know, but definitely was getting close to him in the dark in this party.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and when that, he's standing in that dark room and he's trying to figure out what the hell's going on, and then somebody else comes in and does the same thing he did, which is leave the door open. The
door!
That light is shining right on her. You know, and there she is with that guy, and you know, of course, he just leaves. Which,
yeah,
that was the best thing he could have done, because anything else that he would have done would have reflected poorly. Kind of like, I don't know, kind of like an FBI agent breakdancing with his gun in his
back pocket. Oh shit! That thing's crazy, and then he goes off as he picks it up. That was nuts.
So but, you know, he left the room, did what he needed to do, and got the hell out of there. But you know, there's the first crack in that relationship, and does it survive? You know, I mean, that's
no, it's not just a crack. I think from that exit, which, you know, does kind of go a 50-50 on, is that more of like a cowardly running away, not wanting to deal with it exit? But it certainly says communication will be broken down for the foreseeable future. So sorry, chick. I could have totally waited for you to talk about this outside. But if I did, then I would go back in and beat the shit out of that Philip guy. So I bounced.
So here's a question for you. And it's something that I just noticed when I looked up at my screen, because the episode that we've recapped is over and I just kind of stopped it. So who got the guest actor Emmy nomination?
I'm not sure. Who was that?
That's what I'm wondering. Mindhunter has, it says right there under the breakdown for episode 9, because I paused before 9 started, it says right under the little episode 9 teaser, it says Emmy nominee guest actor.
Oh, I guess
so. Somebody,
find out.
Somebody on Mindhunter.
I shall check right now. Let's see. Mindhunter.
Oh, it's perfect.
Who is it?
It looks to me like the guy that plays
Rudos.
No. It's Cameron Brighton for playing Edmund Kemper.
Oh wow, nice. Yeah, so yeah. it's more for like the series, not for the particular episode number, you know, like so right. It's just because they added that, it probably under each episode it says
yeah, it'll be under every episode, right. So yeah, our Kemper lookalike is up for an Emmy nomination. So
well, that's what I think. That's like, you know, that had to happen. If that didn't happen, there's something wrong with the system. Not that there isn't something wrong with the system, but
I'm just going to say Saturday Night Live leading with nominations tells me there is something wrong with the system. I've stopped. Maybe it's just my age showing, but I gave up on it a long time ago.
I haven't watched Saturday Night Live in a long time either, because I just
from the Belushi, Murray, Aykroyd era, and it's just that's it for me. I can't.
Well, I was from the next classic era, which was like the Mike Myers and Dana Carvey and Kevin Nealon and Adam Sandler and all that. But the other thing was that I think for the first time in history, Netflix beat HBO in the number of Emmy nods, which is like, oh shit, like yep. Undeniable now.
It's the shape of things to come.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just the way. And you know what? Shows like this, the things that we do here are the next wave, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
The next wave. If you're entertained by it, then you know, it's then hopefully you'll tell two friends and they'll tell two friends, like the old 70s shampoo commercial and so on and so on. And pretty soon we'll have millions of people dialing this thing up and listening to it just because we're saying the things that everybody out there is thinking, you know?
Yeah. You know, the one
talk about when they go to the water cooler,
there's that too. Yeah, and there's always, you know, there's always that one time you talk to that friend who says, yeah, but you didn't notice this, and you're like, oh, fuck, now it's going to change the whole way I see this episode. I got to go rewatch it. Nope. The one last thing, I guess, that we didn't mention for the episode is that Holden gets two phone calls throughout the course of the episode, and they're both from the chairman of the Board of Ed of the school district that the principal teaches in. And they're both basically trying to get Holden to say, like, hey, so give us the lowdown for real. This guy's a problem, right? Like, should we get rid of this guy? You know, what do you think we should do? And, you know, I think he kind of says, well, I can't give an opinion on that. But he also sort of confirms his feeling that there's something inappropriate about the way he's behaving. And then in the last minutes of the episode, he gets a call saying, hey, just we wanted to let you know that he's been let go from the board. Like, we let him go from the school.
So this is your actions have consequences moment for him.
Right. And that's exactly what Daniels was pissed about and wanted him to think about going forward.
Because you didn't come out and say this, but it still happened. You know, I mean, you didn't come out and say, well, you need to fire this guy, but now it's been done. You've just changed a person's life. You've just affected a man's career. And he's been a principal for 15 years. He's been in education for how long? There's never his... Like he's telling him in their argument, and it doesn't matter which side of the coin you fall on with, you know, how you saw that, is he's basically saying, look, I have a spotless history.
You know? Right.
That's one of two things. Either A, yes, you have, or B, you've managed to keep people quiet.
Right. Or you've never been caught until now, stuff like that. Yeah. There's another thing too, where, I mean, all right, sure, the actions have consequences, but so does the principal's actions. I mean, if we're going to be trying to, you know, and this is definitely something for next episode, spoiler alert, but if there's going to be blame being thrown at Holden, it's like, well, what about this principal who could have just as easily stopped doing this as soon as everybody said stop doing it? And this is whole thing ends and goes away.
And that's where it really shows, you know, that's where it really shows that he had this guy figured out. And whether he was right or wrong, the bottom line was when you've got teachers complaining, when you've got parents complaining, you know, the kids, you can't have the kids complain. They're not old enough to even understand what's going on.
Exactly.
they're getting candy out of the deal. They don't understand. They have no idea what's happening.
I mean, isn't the whole idea of statutory rape that you're taking advantage of the fact that the person is too young to understand the implications of their actions? And it's like, how is this any different? Yet he's using that the kids are happy as his defense, you know, and it's crazy the way the mind is doing these kinds of mental gymnastics to justify things.
But see, it's the same justification you see from Brutus during the interview in the prison. It's the same mindset. That principle is showing the same mindset you see from Brutus. And I think you see that parallel there. Like in the first two times that he sees him, not in the argumentative conflict at the end, but the first couple of times that you see him, that you're seeing a parallel to Brutus. And what Holden is trying to say is this guy is a Brutus waiting to happen.
And that is again reinforced by the foreshadowing of him editing the speech, yes, being the cold open instead of the BTK.
Exactly.
Because BTK is somebody who is already further down the line, who just hasn't been discovered yet. Whereas this guy is just starting to show his signs. And this is the person. It's funny. Like Holden's giving a speech to this school about how to notice disturbing behavior so that people can report it, so that they can catch it before it gets too bad. And the principal is the one that's you know, displaying it, you know, exhibiting the disturbing behavior.
Yes. Now, if we're wrapped, I have a teaser for next episode.
Oh, all right. I think we're wrapped because I can't think of anything else.
Okay. Well, the open for the next episode that we're going to see on episode 9, I'm going to tell you what happened in that.
Oh, shit. Yeah, because I watched that earlier today and I remember seeing that going like, whoa. What is this, time number one for this guy? And it very well could be.
No.
Oh,
no. Not number one, because number one is the Oteros and it's a family of four. Nope.
But this house is a house that we saw him in before, though. That's one of the things, right? That this is the house that we saw from the cold open like 3 or 4 episodes ago, where she's like, oh, I didn't know you were still in the house, you know, and it's
in that neighborhood. And like I said, so I'm going to hang on to it. I'm not going to spoil it, but I'm going to, as one of the Hollow Nine agents assigned to this case, I'm going to lay that one out for you and tell you how it went down and give you almost sort of Ed Rader's description of what took place in that house, because you see him after he gets rid of the cup and you see that little jack up moment that he has where he gets all excited. I will share all of that.
Oh my God. That means something. Shit. All right. Yes. Yeah, man. That's the kind of show this is. They have some crazy people on here. So, thank God they've sent some crazy agents to decode and, help you digest. Anything you want to pimp before we go going on for you over at TW Brownland?
I'm happy to say that I'm back to writing. I should have a new Dead book out in a few months. I took a little hiatus. Just a memo to you on the Hollow Nine world of things. We put our first Honey Super on our Hive last week. So from this point forward on the Hive on the right-hand side, the honey is being produced that we'll be able to harvest. So, some zombie cata honey coming out to Hollow Nine by the end of summer.
Oh yeah, that's awesome! Cannot wait.
I'll have to send 2 jars because I know you won't give it away if it's the only one I send. I'm gonna keep one and give the other one out.
I'm gonna be making some tea with that honey and some lemon. Oh my God, it's gonna be so good.
Just had my first taste of it, and it was unlike anything I've ever had. But yeah, for me, it's just out here. It's the writing thing is in full swing. And next week, I start water rescue training with my Newfies with the official Northwest Newfoundland's Club group out at a lake here locally, and work on getting them their first certification by the end of summer.
Cool. Cool. Awesome, man. Well, you know, at the Hollow Nine, we've got this show and so many other shows in production in various stages of production. Tangent City writing is back on track now, and or at least is back started up. And I mean, on track will be, it'll be finished soon, but we're at least moving the cars forward along the track again. We also, not this weekend, but next weekend, are going to be launching at least the first two tiers of our Patreon. So we're really excited about that. And next month in August, we're going to do our Podathon to celebrate our 1 year anniversary. But plus, we've got a whole bunch of videos that are going to be coming out soon, kind of to help celebrate that 1 year, as well as some stuff from the interview I did actually yesterday with Mr. G. Tom Mack from the one of the songwriters. We've seen him. His music has been in a lot of movies, including Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But most famously and most sort of standout-ish would be he wrote the theme song to The Lost Boys, Cry Little Sister, and has a musical coming out based on The Lost Boys called The Lost Boys Story. So got to sit down with him for like an hour and just chat about what it was like to write that song and work on the musical and all the stuff that's coming out. So plenty of collateral on that to be seen very soon. Yeah, man, it's just so much going on. So much awesome stuff to watch, too. That's the other thing. There's so many great shows out there to watch, so many awesome movies to watch. One of the things we're doing for the Patreon is a thing called Watch It Clone, where I am going to be kind of watching shows and doing a quick what I think the show's going to be like right before the episode, and then a 10-minute wrap on what the episode was like. And right now I'm going through the first season of Northern Exposure, and that's going to be something that's packaged for our Patreon followers as well. So big things to keep your eyes open for coming from the Hollow Nine, including more apparel featuring our logo. So for all those out there who are looking for ways to support us, we're going to have plenty of ways for you to do that. And look out for us at a whole bunch of events coming up, like Dragon Con in Atlanta, New Jersey Horror Con and Film Festival in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and then New York Comic Con in New York City in October. So that's August, September, and October. Got a lot going on. So you really, I don't see how it's possible for you to miss it. But just in case, keep your ears to Hollow9.com, the Hollow Nine Network page on Facebook, at Hollow9Cast on Twitter, and here on YouTube for all kinds of live streams and stuff that we're gonna be doing, covering it all.
And for the people listening, how do they spell Hollow Nine?
Oh, that would be the word Hollow, the number nine, INE. I think after the 1 year anniversary, I'm gonna stop spelling it. At that point, like, guys, we've been around for a while. I'm pretty sure you should know. But yeah, the word Hollow, the number nine, INE.com, cast at or at Hollow9Cast. Yeah, and you could also shoot me a note at clone@hollow9.com. That's KLONE at hollow9.com. That'll get its way to me. So until we come back to talk about the next episode of Mindhunter, I guess this is we'll wrap up on episode 8. Another successful meeting of the Hollow9 Network Behavioral Sciences Unit. Thank you for checking in with us, and meeting adjourned. See you next time.
You've been listening to the Hollow9 Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. That's the word Hollow, the number nine, INE. Now broadcasting from our new home on the web, Hollow9.com, where you can find info on all of our awesome programming as well as the team behind the shows. Leave us your feedback, join in the conversation, and be a part of the action. Find the Hollow9 Network on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email us at info@hollow9.com or at hollow9podcast@gmail.com. Join in the fun. Hollow9!